This is a podcast from the British Council's Going Global 2013.
Good afternoon, everyone, and welcome to our session on developing strategic international partnerships. Before we came to the session, they told us there would be 500 people in this room. So we assumed that the doors are locked and people can't get through. But we thank you anyhow for joining us and look forward to a very lively discussion. What constitutes a strategic partnership? How do higher education institutions select and identify strategic partners? How do they manage and sustain these partnerships? And how do universities move from the very incidental collaborations to more intentional partnerships? So those are some of the questions we're trying to answer here in the next 75 minutes or so. We have the session divided in two main sections, one looking at the national perspectives and a theoretical framework around strategic internationalization and where strategic international partnerships fit. And then we hear from two representatives from institutions who will look at the institutional perspectives, their approaches to developing these types of strategic partnerships. My name is Daniel Obst. I'm the Deputy Vice President for International Partnerships at the Institute of International Education in New York. And just as a way of introduction to the organization I work for, IIE is a nonprofit organization based in New York that was founded almost 100 years ago. And now we're one of the largest international education organizations. Each year we administer about 250 programs for almost 30,000 participants. These are students, scholars, teachers, and other professionals. Our core work, of course, revolves around the scholarship and fellowship administration and the development of training programs. For example, we administer the Fulbright program on behalf of the U.S. government and many other federally funded exchange programs. We are expanding our work with the government of Brazil on their Brazil Scientific Mobility Program. And we're very active here in the region as well, work, for example, with NYU Abu Dhabi and with KAUST, the King Abdullah University of Science and Technology in Saudi Arabia. In 2009, we launched a Center for International Partnerships in Higher Education. And the idea really behind the center was to help assist higher education institutions in developing a more strategic approach to their international partnership planning and their international engagement. We take a very country-focused approach. So we work with institutions who are looking to develop and find strategic partners in specific countries. So we've done this in India, in Brazil, in China, in Indonesia, to some extent in Iraq, and now also in Myanmar. And IIE's president, Alan Goodman, and I just came back last week from the first U.S. higher education delegation to Myanmar. And the idea really was there to identify ways in which American institutions can partner with institutions in that country. About a year ago, we published a book called Developing Strategic International Partnerships. And before I introduce the panel, I just want to make 3 points from that book that help put this session into context. The first point is that international partnerships are no longer simply one tactic of internationalization, but a core driving philosophy. So the idea is that institutions are really rethinking the way, the reasons for pursuing international partnerships and the processes by which they pursue them. We're seeing a very new landscape of new types of partnerships, new policies that guide them, and new procedures that help institutions implement and sustain them. So many different institutions, and we will hear different examples here, are exploring the potential of international partnerships in very different ways. So the landscape we see is still emerging. It's quite complex, but it's also a very dynamic landscape. The second point is that international partnerships are being asked to do more now than that has been the case in the past. 20 years ago, international partnerships were mostly about student exchanges, with only a few examples of collaborative research or capacity building. But now the goals of partnerships have multiplied, the geographical span has widened and deepened, and most importantly, partnerships have been supplemented with other forms. So some of the new goals of partnerships include curriculum development, advancing research, tackling pressing global issues, and the pursuit of public diplomacy and national priorities, as we've heard yesterday in a session on soft power, and we will hear a little bit about this today as well. And finally, the third point is that successful international partnerships, and especially the strategic ones, invoke what we call in the book the power of collaboration and an ethos of mutuality. So So the idea being that there's something to be gained from working together that cannot be accomplished alone, and that strategic partnerships can really have a truly transformative impact on the entire institutions, and that they produce new initiatives, new activities that go way beyond what was originally planned in the partnership. So with this context, I would like to introduce our panelists. As I said, we're divided into two broader sections. We will start with looking at the framework of strategic internationalization and where international partnerships fit in, and also look at some of the national perspectives. So we will start with Dr. Hans Pohl, who is the program director at the Swedish Foundation for International Cooperation in Research and Higher Education. And he will talk about findings from a survey that talk about the rationales for strategic internationalization. Then we will hear from Dr. Nina Lemmens, who is the Director of Internationalization and Communications at the German Academic Exchange Service, the DAAD. And Nina will talk about a new funding program that the DAAD just launched this year, and that specifically helps to provide support to German institutions who are looking to develop strategic partnerships. So we will hear about the rationales of the DAAD for doing this and what they hope to achieve with it. We will then move to the second section of our session, and with Suzanne Alexander, who is the director of the International Office at the University of Leicester in the UK and was previously a director of promotions at the British Council. And she will discuss the extent to which international partnerships are supported or driven by national policies, and will discuss the institutional rationales and motivations for forming partnerships. And finally, we will hear from Matthias Kuda, who is the head of the Liaison Office Network at the Center for International Cooperation at the Freie Universität in Berlin in Germany. And he will discuss his institution's process of identifying strategic partners and provide some specific case studies. So with that, Hans, the floor is yours.
You have the clicker? Where is the clicker?
Who has the clicker? Okay.
That helps. Thank you, Daniel, for the introduction. I come from the Swedish Foundation for International Cooperation in Research and Higher Education, or a short name, STINT, as we normally call it. And STINT was set up in 1994 by an active Swedish parliament. And we have just one very simple mission, and that is to internationalize Swedish higher education and research. And this we do through a number of different programs, mainly targeting the mobility of researchers and university lecturers. And my role at STINT is I serve as a program director, so basically I try to make sure that we get value for the money. The study I will present today is about strategic internationalization in Sweden. And we have two aims in this study. The first aim is to develop and test a set of activities and rationales related to this internationalization of higher education. And using this framework, we have also studied the Swedish higher education institution leadership's agendas for internationalization. And theoretical inspiration comes mainly from Jane Knight, who is talking in a parallel session right now, but with some changes. Her framework encompasses a large number of activities and rationales on the national sector and institutional level, whereas this framework has an institutional focus. We have also tried to reduce the overlap between different activities and rationales and added some recent trends. As you said, it's a quite rapidly emerging topic. The empirical data for this study is based on a call that we made last year from STINT called Strategic Grants for Internationalizations, where university presidents or vice chancellors were asked to submit proposals and maybe get 50%, maximum 50% co-funding from us. The call had very open selection criteria, so it meant that these university presidents could propose almost anything that related to strategic internationalization. and indeed we did as well. And we got 31 applications from 20 different universities, which given that we have a little bit more than 40 universities in Sweden is a very good response rate, especially as we were only allowed to propose maximum 2 applications per institution. And these applications were then scrutinized by internationalization experts, and finally 5 winners were selected. If we look at these applications, we can see that there are 2 different types of internationalization, either internationalization at home or cross-border or even borderless internationalization. And 29% of applications focused on internationalization at home, with mainly international students and other components related to on-campus internationalization. Of the cross-border applications, 55% targeted networks. That means projects involving at least 3 different parties. If we look when mapping all these applications against the framework, this framework has 4 different types of activities: education, research, service for admission, and overarching and enabling activities, as you can see by the colors on this slide. And the most mentioned activity in the applications was international students, inbound international students. And there is maybe one reason for this, as we in Sweden very recently introduced tuition fees for non-European students. So this is an issue high on the agenda right now. As you also can see, the blue bars are quite long, all of them. So there is a strong focus on the educational aspects in these international collaborations. Secondly, the main topic of this session, international linkages, partnerships, and networks were mentioned in almost 61% of applications. And thirdly, management and administration, that means, was mentioned in almost 50% of applications. And this is maybe a little bit surprising, as Sweden is considered quite an international country. We have a good, high proportion of English-speaking people and a very international industry. But obviously still, the universities consider that the internal resources to handle internationalization need to be improved. Finally, it could be mentioned here that offshoring and branch campuses, which was one of the new activities added to the framework, wasn't considered in any of the applications. If we move to the rationales in the proposals, there are also 4 different types of rationales: enhancement of quality, knowledge production, service for admission, and overarching and enabling. Among the rationales, as you can see, almost a little bit more than 7 out of 10 applications mentioned international branding, profile, and status as the main rationale for this internationalization project. And this is probably linked to the general trend towards more need for, international competition between different higher education institutions, and also partly related, I guess, to the need for more inbound students. Secondly, follows very broad rationale, student and staff development, and third, knowledge production. As a fourth, every fourth application mentioned innovation as a rationale for internationalization, and this incorporated, for example, partnerships with industry and focus on entrepreneurship and things like that. So, to conclude, we can first of all note that this call, first round of this call, was positively received with a lot of applications, good quality. And right now we have a second call open for applications for Swedish universities. We have also can note that we have demonstrated a new modified theoretical framework, which at least for this purpose served its role quite good, but there is still a need for further development. When you ask the university leadership what are their key priorities right now in terms of key activities, their main activities are international students inbound and international partnerships. And the main rationale in Sweden, at least, is branding, international profile. So, finally, maybe not so much a conclusion, but more like a comment or even question, is that it appears as if internationalization of education requires more top-down involvement than internationalization of research, at least according to how the university leadership in Sweden focuses their efforts. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Great, thank you, Hans. And it's interesting to see in the research that reputation and branding is one of the key motivating factors that make institutions engage in strategic internationalization, and we have found similar things in our studies. Now, Nina Lemons to provide an overview of what the DAAD is doing to specifically encourage German universities to engage in strategic partnerships.
Hello, everybody. Just a quick word about the DAAD in case you haven't heard of us, the German Academic Exchange Service, Deutscher Akademischer Austauschdienst, hence DAAD, is a publicly funded organization which is yet privately organized because we are a membership organization of all the German universities. And we provide scholarships and funding for people who want to go abroad for a certain stay to go to university or do some research abroad, and also for international scholars to come to Germany. And we provide structural programs, as we call them, and this is what I'm going to talk about today, for the German universities, and also we try to provide the German public with expertise on higher education all over the world. So the German higher education system has undergone major shifts in recent years. Some catchworks, Which one do I have to click? The palm? Or the big one?
I think, yep.
Thank you. So some catchwords are the Bologna process, the excellence initiative. I'm not going to go into details, but I could explain later. The internationalization audit and the mergers of institutions. They may come to mind. Altogether, this has led to the reshaping of the German higher education system or landscape in a way which was unheard of, at least in the last 50 years or even after World War II. As a result, German higher education institutions have given or are giving themselves more sharply defined profiles. Germany still is, and proudly so, a country with a very high mobility rates amongst its students, graduates, and staff, both on the incoming and outgoing side. Although mobility is a key element of internationalization, it is not the only crucial ingredient for a successful international strategy. Hence, German universities are at the moment revising all of their international activities and corporations and are creating comprehensive strategies for internationalization, which are both driven by a bottom-up approach by the academics and researchers in the field, as well as by top-down decisions by the university leadership. So this ties in with what Hans has just mentioned. Here the aim is to include more international route map into the overall agenda of the university. This leads to a certain house cleaning with regards to the often big number of international agreements and the demand for more strategically planned international relations has become louder and louder. And we heard this cry. And so, as we try to feel the pulse of the universities in Germany, we have proposed last year a new funding project program to the Ministry for Education and Research, which is one of our core funding bodies, and it was accepted and the necessary funds were allocated. This first call for proposal was announced in March last year, and it comprised of two major schemes called strategic partnerships and thematic networks. Scheme A, the strategic partnerships, is in its core an agreement for cooperation between one German and up to five international higher education institutions in one or more subject areas and on different levels throughout the whole university. It is intended that thus the strategic partnership will raise the quality of research and teaching and foster a multidisciplinary approach. The partnership will not only implement the internationalization strategies in every one of the related universities, but also raise the attractiveness of the university to staff and students in Germany and abroad, hopefully. Scheme B, thematic networks, on the other hand, is more a classical approach that you all know. It provides a wide range of funding instruments to create subject-oriented networks, again, between up to one German and five international universities or research institutions. The aim is to enhance excellent research and especially foster young international researchers. Obviously, this new program hit the nail on the head as we received 117 proposals in the first call. 21, I have to say that we have slightly more universities than Sweden, so this might be one of the reasons for the different numbers. 21 were awarded the funding for up to 250,000 euros per annum for 4 years, so a total of up to 1 million euros per project, which could be provided. The overall budget for the program will hence rise to 4.5 million euros as of next year, and we sincerely hope to be able to launch a second call anytime soon. Here you can see some of the things that the universities can apply for. So they can apply for participation in conferences, workshops, study and research visits, something that's very important to them. They can hire somebody to run this partnership, and exchange of administrative staff and so on. We expect that the partner universities will also be able to provide some funds. They can also be in kind, but they have to come up with something. So not only the German partner pays. In our first assessment of the winning proposals, we could see that there seem to be about four different formats that are most favored by the universities, and I would like to briefly present them to you. The star-shaped type, which is the one in the left-hand corner on the upper side, shows one German university, in my example, Frankfurt, like the center of a star, holding mainly bilateral agreements with four different partner universities, which are all top-ranked institutions, and are all situated, and that's a very nice twist, in twinning towns of Frankfurt. I don't know if the concept of twinning towns is known all over the world, but German cities seem to have a lot of twinning towns, and so Frankfurt shows these twinning towns and their universities, which is a very good idea because this star-shaped type or this strategic partnership concentrates very much on the connection of business and industry and higher education. And of course, Frankfurt is the financial hub of Germany. So this is, I think, a very good idea. The wheel-shaped type, which you can see on the right-hand side, here shown by the example of the U4 network, comprised of Göttingen, the universities of Göttingen, Groningen in the Netherlands, Ghent in Belgium, and Uppsala in Sweden. All partners are collaborating with each other. At the core of this partnership lies the belief that only joint research efforts will help in solving major research challenges that we are facing in the world. The bilateral type, I guess, is familiar to everyone in this room. However, I would like to point out that the cooperation I'm presenting here, which is between the Technical University of Aachen, one of our excellence universities, and the Tsinghua University in China, is extremely intensive. It has been going on for more than 30 years, and it includes systematic and comprehensive interconnectedness on all possible levels And at the heart lies a joint master program. So that also shows where things can get a starting point. The fourth model is the pyramid type, here presented by the University of Marburg and two Chinese universities. While Marburg holds more or less bilateral agreements with both Tongji and Jiayang University, the three partners share their focus on certain research areas and run a joint graduate school. So I want to stop here, but of course we could go into more detail later in the discussion. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Oops. Thank you, Nina. And now we'll switch from kind of the national and theoretical framework to the institutional framework. And Suzanne Alexander will start us off to talk about how her institution is approaching strategic partnerships, but also how institutions in the UK are generally doing this. All right. And then you just press the... It's the technical challenges.
The technical challenges are always the ones that defeat us. Thanks, Daniel. So good afternoon, everyone. As Daniel said, I'm going to kind of act as a transition between what we've just heard about two different national approaches and the importance of partnerships to try and bring it both into the UK context and also the institutional context, what it actually looks like to be on the receiving end of some of these initiatives, and whether we always want to be. And I think I have to start by...
The big one on the top.
Yeah.
Putting some of this into context, and it would be disingenuous of me to say that international student recruitment isn't at the core of the international agenda of most, if not all, UK universities, and that there is an economic imperative associated with this. I'm sure many people in this room are aware of the funding model of UK universities, which does mean that since the early 1980s, most all higher education institutions, although we are publicly funded to some extent, we've had to generate more and more, an increasing level of our own income from other sources. And one of the most important ways that we've been able to do this is through the tuition fees that international students pay to attend degree programs in the UK, and which has been introduced by other countries, as mentioned, for example, Sweden most recently. And over the years, that proportion has grown. So in the last year for which I could find reliable statistics, international student fee income made up 9.6% of the university's total income. And it's that increasing reliance on international student fees, which is a matter of concern for universities, I'd have to say. We're working in a very volatile environment, a dynamic environment, and we can never be sure what the future will hold. And we must always view international student recruitment, that reliance on fees, as a strategic risk. However, international student recruitment is certainly not just a question of numbers meeting targets at any cost. If we did that, we would sacrifice the only thing that we really have to offer, and that is our academic integrity, the reputation that we think the UK has for the quality and the perceived global value of our degrees. But it means that we then have major concerns resulting from our reliance on international students coming to us. Sustainability, of course, ensuring that we can continue to recruit in this very dynamic environment. The diversity of our students, the source countries, the different places that they may come from, and of course, the subject areas that they study. We want this diversity both for our institutions, but also, of course, for the sake of the student experience. And quality. We always, all universities, want to attract the best quality students to their institution, so we need to offer an attractive range of possibilities. And those same principles, the principles of diversity, sustainability and quality, are the underpinning principles that support the broader context and objectives of internationalization in universities. So thinking about then the place of partnerships in that context, I've set that context, and we've got an international strategy, internationalization strategies. The imperative of international student recruitment hasn't changed, but the ways in which we support that strategy have had to change considerably over the years, and the work that we need to do to support it. And this, of course, is where international partnerships have become, I think, for most, a critical element in their international strategies. All our international objectives do, to some extent, depend on partnerships. And that term, as has been mentioned, covers a really diverse set of activities delivered both at home and indeed overseas. It started, as was mentioned, with international student and then staff mobility. We can all probably remember those early days of student exchanges, which of course continue, but of themselves, they're just a small step on the path to internationalization. So we move from staff and student mobility to articulation arrangements to institutional outreach. And again, we do that in very many different ways, be it distance learning, and I was delighted to meet one of our current distance learning students today here in Dubai. Franchising, what are sometimes called boutique campuses, which you're very familiar with here. And boutique simply means that they offer a small range of subjects which suit the local economic conditions and demands from students, or even fully fledged, comprehensive overseas campuses. All of these are dependent on ranges of partnerships. And of course, the more complex the relationship, the more strategic it needs to be. And the partnerships also are working on collaboration leading to capacity building and development. So all of these are different aspects together with collaborative research. Models of partnership mentioned again by both our current previous speakers, whether they're bilateral, multilateral, whether they're informal or formal networks or consortia. And they may, of course, also involve industrial or governmental partners as well. I think the only limits that we have in terms of what partnerships look like are actually our imagination. But there are actually other challenges, and the challenges really, I think, are our capacity at an institutional level to take on, to manage effectively, and to sustain more and more partnership activity. And those are, for institutions, very, very real challenges. So if I look at some of the initiatives that we have in the UK for supporting partnerships in institutions, we have one which is extremely well known, the British Council, have been at work for 70 years in all kinds of education engagement. But we also have two that are perhaps not so well known to an audience outside the UK, and those are the UK HE International Unit, which comes out of Universities UK and certain other bodies that support the whole higher education sector in England and the devolved administrations of Wales, Northern Ireland and Scotland. And most recently, in just the last couple of months, a new initiative called Education UK, which builds on the Education UK brand that we have developed over a number of years, and which is a joint initiative between two government departments, UKTI, Trade and Investment, and the BIS, which Business Innovation and Skills is actually, despite its name, the Ministry of Education in the UK, but the word education is somehow missing. I don't know what I should read into that. All of these provide, in much the same way as DRD and many other and institutes of international education, all sorts of projects, missions and initiatives in which UK higher education institutions are invited to take part. The difficulties for us are not just their sheer diversity, but counterbalancing a lot of these positive initiatives, we have rather ambiguous and contradictory indicators from other government departments. So, for example, UKBA, the UK's immigration agency. It's a complex operating environment. On the one hand, we may find ourselves very much encouraged by government to enter into all kinds of new initiatives, and in another, may be not so supported by other areas of government. It's all part of the complex environment of change, policy change, that is affecting our sector at the moment. But behind all of this, institutions go ahead and we look at our own ways of forming our strategy for international engagement through partnerships. How do we translate all of that into policy and implementation at the departmental level, at the institutional level? We've got very, very many models of success, and we've also got a few cautionary tales of failure where things have not worked out. What we can see is when we have all these very many opportunities, we do need to be strategic in our approach. We do need, first of all, to know ourselves, to know our own institutional objectives and priorities, to be very clear where we stand, what we do want to do, what we should not do, what we cannot do. We need to know our own capacity of our institution, our own priorities. And these are very important before we can respond and then take on all these new opportunities that are coming to us. What we can see, as I say, is a need to know all about ourselves, to focus very clearly on how we're going to manage risk and how we're going to assure quality. We do not do ourselves any favour by stretching ourselves beyond our ability to manage the partnerships effectively. And it's not just starting the partnerships, it's the longer term sustainability and development of those partnerships, which will, as we've all found, evolve over time. And Matthias will say more about that. If I do just move on then to the final part on what sorts of factors can we see as critical then in our success. A few lessons we've learned. We absolutely have to have an appropriate structure for decision making. We must know who is going to lead the strategy, who is going to take the decisions, and not just enter into every opportunity that comes our way. At the same time, we need to be very open to new opportunities, because something may well come up that's not in our plan, but which we can see fits our institutional priorities, objectives, and our capacity to deliver. Due diligence, I don't need to say more, but if you don't do your research at the beginning, it's definitely too late after you've started your strategic partnership. Expecting the relationships to evolve. We need to know who's responsible at all times, and it will change. There will be changes in our own institution, and there will be changes in our partner institutions. We have to be aware of all of this. Communication throughout every part of a partnership is going to be clear and critical to its success. The partnership is a two-way relationship, at least. It could be multilateral. And we always have to remember that. Look at things not only from our perspective, but that of the partner, to understand where we will get that mutuality that was mentioned as such a critical part of partnerships. Experience and information, we learn from every partnership we have what to do and what not to do. Very important. The review, the regular review of our partnerships to ensure quality is, of course, very, very important. The partnerships only have meaning so long as they are delivering a quality set of relationships for our students, our staff, and the wider community which we are serving. From the outset, we need to know what our expectations from the partnership are. And that's why negotiating agreements between partners is so important. All the time spent in the initial stages of talking to each other, understanding each other's needs and expectations, is time well spent. Trust is essential in a relationship, but nothing beats a really good negotiating session where all of the possible expectations and difficulties are ironed out in advance. You won't cover everything, but you'll certainly understand where the similarities and differences are. If finance is involved, obviously it has to be discussed in great detail. And the final part, not all partnerships will be successful. There will be ways in which the partnership has evolved so that you have to recognise that it does not have a future for either of you. And that is one of the most difficult things. If you think that starting a partnership is hard, ending one is infinitely harder. And I think that's probably one of the biggest lessons we've learned. And I'd be happy to say more if I had more time. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Suzanne. And our final presentation will be from Matthias Kuda, who will talk about his institution's approach to strategic partnership, and will give a few case studies, I think, of how he approaches this.
Right. Thank you, Daniel. Thank you very much, Daniel. Good afternoon, everybody. It's my pleasure to present to you today the approach that Freie Universität Berlin has taken with regard to establishing or developing strategic partnerships. I should point out that our approach is a lesson that we are still learning, and so I do not wish to present to you a best case scenario or example that you should just copy. Rather, it's a learning process that I would like to share with you, and to share with you some of the actually points that all of our speakers today already mentioned, and you will probably at the end, or hopefully at the end, also get some critical challenges that we have experienced in order to maybe be better prepared in your own institution. We started our thinking about strategic partnerships in 2008. That was at a time when we just won the Excellence Initiative in Germany and we were about to implement our internationalization strategy. Our leadership thought that in order to be more strategic about internationalization, we need to have goals, which is always good. And the goals that you see on my slide are pretty much the same, or the motivations are pretty much the same or very similar to what already Hans and others talked about. So I wouldn't say that we are exceptionally clever in this field. I think that most universities out there who think about internationalization and wants to define goals will probably come up with these or similar goals that they want to achieve. I just want to point out to you one particular goal that we thought is very important to us, which is developing joint PhD programs as well as developing joint postdoc initiatives. In order to do that, we realized we need to know who are the partners that we work with internationally that you can really do that with. So you're not talking about an exchange program, you're not talking about just simple mobility, you're talking about structures that are entirely different to what our experience until then has been. And that kind of interaction requires a different level of trust, a different level of knowledge of each other, a different level of commitment that was mentioned as well, and mutual understanding that this is something that both partners will actually benefit from. So our leadership, having defined those goals, then said, which of our 150 plus partnerships that we have would be the right ones to help us as strategic partnerships achieve those goals? Which of our partnerships, offer that kind of environment that you need to actually do that? And the answer, of course, was, well, you go out and find them. You identify the partners that are particularly synergetic. Now, there was a nice move of our leadership, because usually you get a list of universities that you're supposed to work with, and we all know that it doesn't work. So in the beginning, we thought this is fantastic, but then how do you actually translate that into action? And the guidelines we got from the leadership was, that was coming top-down. Nina mentioned this top-down approach as well. You go out and stalk the researchers, because that will tell you they work with people that they want to work with, and if you understand whom they work with, that might actually help you understand our own institution better. Then there was another top-down order, which was, please try to focus on partners in countries where there is a high or growing research potential, particularly in the East. We've been looking towards the West, Western Europe, the U.S. since our founding in 1948. We were founded by the Americans, so we had very strong research links in this sphere anyway. But try to look east. Try to understand which are the partners out there that we work with a lot. And try to make sure that we're not talking about individual researchers that establish strategic partnerships, but we're talking about an initiative within the university that includes at least three different departments, because that gives you a basis that you can work with. And something that was very important, especially in the German context, our budgets do not allow for a lot of playing around. If we want to establish new research partnerships, we need third-party funding. And that means that whatever strategic partnerships we want to establish, we need to ensure that there actually is funding that we can try to gain. Otherwise, most of the projects we agree with our partners on will never be funded and never actually happen. And the leadership decided is we need a unit, and that was mentioned as well, we need a central unit that will be actually looking after that process. And first we called it monitoring process. Then we realized researchers do not like the word monitoring, so we called it mapping. That sounded much, much nicer. The mapping process, we thought, needs to have some indicators. We need to understand what we can look at, what indicators we have in our university that will help us understand what our university researchers actually do, with whom and where. And you see a set of indicators we looked at. I will not go through all of them, but what was very, very helpful to look at our research database. All of our third-party funded research is actually listed in a database, and that also provides you the information of whether or not that particular research project has an international partner involved, which tells you then the story of which universities your researchers work with the most. There's another couple of indicators that we used. One interesting exercise we did, we actually told our departments through target agreements, which we do every 2 years, that they should design their own internationalization strategy as well as provide a report about their international cooperation, which means their institutes and researchers, which has never been done before. They were surprised, they were overwhelmed, and they were unfortunately also not really able to provide a strategy. What they were able to provide was much more of a report of the status quo. It was not complete, but I'd say for the first time in the history of our university, we were actually able to have a set of information from all of our departments that indicated all the projects that we never knew about. Not only didn't we know about them, most of our people within the departments and the institutes didn't know about their colleagues' projects. And suddenly, not only the leadership knew much more about the institution, but also the colleagues, sometimes working with similar partners, realized, we could maybe do something together and jointly. So that was a very interesting exercise, despite the fact, of course, that at the beginning the departments did not like that idea. Now, the first results. What you see here is basically, if you look at the 150-plus partnerships you have, and you do all those, you sort of go through the indicators, do all this, all these things, then suddenly you see little islands come up within your sea of partnerships, which indicate that there's a lot of activity in many different fields, from research to student mobility. And the activity we've been doing with these partners that you see here has been already going on for many years. And in order to increase that activity even more, in order to achieve those goals that I presented in the beginning, we thought we should definitely have something like a seed money fund, because if there is already many things going on, if there is a lot of interest, let's see if it will create even more interest within the institution. And that actually worked. It actually worked so well that we were able not only to provide seed funding, and we're talking about very small amounts, we're talking about like 10, 20, 30,000 of euros per year, which is not, that much, and we were lucky to have that funding. And with that little funding, we were actually able to obtain another 10 million of euros for new joint research projects, activities such as summer schools, PhD workshops, new development of new study programs, etc. And that you can only achieve, I think, if you don't have to convince your researchers that they should work with these institutions. And this is just the beginning of our development, so there will be more on this plate, but because they already work with them, so they're actually thankful that you provide them extra help in following what they've been doing anyway. So I don't spend my time much on convincing people. I try to make sure that we don't support only the ones that are already working, but share the information about the opportunities with others as well. Now, to the challenges, I think that is something very important. Communication was mentioned. It is an entirely different kind of working, both internally and externally. I am not the best advisor on, finding the right research funding. For that, we have our research department. But our research department usually does not talk to our international partners. Neither does our present communication office. Neither does our academic office. So you suddenly have many units internally within your university that ideally should be in direct contact and communication with your partner institutions. And they are not used to doing this. In our context, it also means, can they actually speak the same language? So it comes down to very, very basic questions. And usually, although most of our researchers and most of our staff are very happy about working internationally, when it comes to day-to-day work, they don't really necessarily want to do that, especially not our staff in our administrative departments. Partly because they have no experience with this. So in order to overcome the challenge, we have started a pilot project with exchanging our staff. So that's just a little tiny way or sort of example of how you can actually overcome some of the challenges. And I think we have still to develop a system that will help us establish a clear and functioning communication within the university that will help us develop such partnerships and help us overcome those the challenge of communication. And I think that was mentioned before as well, you need to make sure that on both sides you have someone who's in charge of not so much doing everything, but coordinating. And it has to be done on both sides because it, you know, otherwise it's not a mutual exercise. And the experience so far has been that the more success you have within such partnerships, the more work they generate. So it's not that you can say after 2 years we're done, everything is fine, we don't need that sort of extra tender loving care. It's actually the other way around. The more they work, which is wonderful, the more work they generate, especially for administrative staff. And I think I would just like to stop here and mention that last challenge. You will probably, if you go in this direction and if you communicate clearly with your researchers, you will certainly find that suddenly there will be people coming to you saying, we want a strategic partnership too. And that's a challenge to explain to our researchers what we as a university consider a strategic partnership for the entire university and what he or she as a researcher might want to do in their little field, which we are very happy about. We don't limit our partnerships to these three or maybe in the future five or six. We have many, many more, but we have partnerships for different purposes with different partners. And I guess that needs to be communicated clearly again to your own staff and faculty. Thank you very much.
Great, thank you. Thank you, Matthias. We now come to the final part of our session, which is to have comments from you, questions, and commentary from the panel. And while we sort out the microphones and while you think of your questions, let me ask a couple things. Matthias, you began your presentation. Suzanne also discussed this, of the specific goals that your institutions had and also that your administration had in particular. But I'm particularly curious about the interplay between the institutional strategies that you have, but then also some of the national strategies. So are there different agendas where the funding comes from? You have one agenda. A country may have specific development priorities that help support the development of partnerships. So how do you align these types of agendas? So maybe Matthias and Suzanne could talk a little bit about their approach to this.
Well, actually, our agenda, you know, it was more of a, we started the development of our partnerships in 2008, and when the DED, you know, came up with this wonderful program, we were already in the process of exactly doing that. And as Nina said, I think this is very important. If you're a funding agency and you listen to the universities on the ground, what they do and what they need in terms of support, then you exactly do that. You come up with a funding program that is needed by the universities to achieve their goals, not so much the goals of the DAD. Or you could also say the goals of the DAD are pretty much, in this case, the goals of the universities.
I think that's right. And this is why the DAAD's projects is of great interest to me, to see that it is so general and basically you are open to partnerships almost anywhere and of almost any kind. If people can convince you, they meet the objectives. I think many government objectives will be driven by other agendas. Sometimes they may be a political agenda for relationship building between countries, and of course there's nothing at all wrong with that. But each institution needs to assess whether that does support our own objectives, which may not be the same. There may be a good alignment, there may be a good match, but it is the reason why we won't all necessarily want to respond to every initiative that comes up in front of us. One of the other things, I think, is also sometimes the initiatives can come with a very tight timescale, which does make it difficult for institutions to respond unless it is absolutely aligned with your existing agenda.
Good, thank you. So we have time for some questions. Where are the questions? So we'll take one here, the lady in the front, and then one in the back there, and then one in the middle there. So we'll take three questions together and then have the panelists address them.
Thank you very much. My name is Zainab Abdelaziz. I am the head of international cooperation at the Egyptian Banking Institute from Egypt. My question will be regarding the stakeholders' part in the international cooperation. Among one of the important factors of any international or any partnership is to identify stakeholders and to ensure stakeholders' involvement. So I want to know what kind of efforts has been done to identify the stakeholders of the partnerships and to ensure the involvement of stakeholders. Thank you very much.
Thank you. So then we had a question.
Oh, here.
Yeah, great.
Duke from Inter-University Partnerships. I've got two questions, if you don't mind. They're both for Hans. I hope that's all right. The first one would be in that Swedish context. Has the introduction of overseas fees, has that so far today had a had an impact on the incoming overseas student numbers? That would be one. And then the second one is a little bit more general question. I was wondering if there's been any discussion on whether there's any scope to pursue your agenda on a regional level within Scandinavia, because unless I'm totally mistaken, I think Denmark passed a bill within their government as well to introduce the fees, and Finland's just behind you. And knowing that those countries do already cooperate on other issues in a number of areas, I was thinking, could they do that in this area as well by the means of setting up, I don't know, Study Scandinavia, Nordic countries type of thing, a bit like British Council has brought in Northern Ireland, Wales, England and Scotland under that one umbrella. And you said that the change really has to come from the top and you need the buy-in. And in that case, it would take it straight up there, the government level, bring in the government agencies and the universities and set up a movement, if you like, a promotional vehicle of that nature. Just if I could have comments on that, that would be interesting.
Good.
Thank you.
And then we'll take the last question there.
This is a question really directed to our colleague from the UK. Do you think that the new QEAA standard, B10, is going to hamper UK's collaborations overseas?
Good. So we have four questions around stakeholders, introduction of fees, regional cooperation, and quality assurance measures. Suzanne, why don't you start?
Well, let me start. For those who don't understand the UK context, we have something called the QAA, the Quality Assurance Agency for Higher Education, which produces a code of practice, has done so for many years. The code of practice is, of course, exactly that. It doesn't have legal status as such, but if you don't comply with its guidance, it wouldn't give you a very secure future, shall we say. So it's guidance, but it's kind of more than guidance. The new code of practice on collaborative provision, which does build on previous codes, the new chapter referred to, does set out a few new provisions, and I think most institutions will simply be reviewing their own codes of practice in regard to collaborative provision to see what differences it makes. In most cases, having just reviewed ours, it doesn't make very much to what we currently do. And I do think it is important to have a code of practice that does inform the ways in which you enter your partnerships for our sake and also for that of the students, staff, and everyone else involved.
And Matthias, I wonder if you can take the question on stakeholders, because I think the stakeholder involvement is key. It also leads to the question of the resistance that might you might encounter in developing a more strategic approach to international partnerships. So how did your institution involve stakeholders?
Well, I would have to say that we limited the notion of stakeholders basically to our researchers. I mean, we, as I said, we wanted to understand what they want. Now, if you ask a researcher what he or she wants, he or she will tell you, well, I work with Hans in Sweden or with Nina in Germany, but they will not tell you I work with the so-and-so university unless they need the labs that exist somewhere else. So it's kind of difficult if you start asking them and involving them in a sort of real way. What we did was more to understand how many of our researchers work with particular institutions via their personal contacts, and that allowed us to understand, you know, if there is a conglomerate of sort of cooperation or a cluster, if you will. If I see that, you know, 35 of our researchers and faculty across all our departments work with the Peking University in Beijing, and only two with the university, with another university in China, then your decision-making process is much easier because you know that your stakeholders are obviously pointing to Beijing, not to the other place. But again, that was the only sort of stakeholder level we looked at. Asking students would be a difficult issue because they have different, you know, interests. We did not ask we did not consider funding agencies as stakeholders. We did look at whether there would be funding opportunities, but we did not ask them whether or not they would, you know, like our approaches or not. I thought that would be a little bit difficult to to include. But so yeah, it was mostly, and the resistance. You know, you all know, or you all are perhaps also researchers, and whenever there's something coming from the university leadership, that will usually be met with a lot of, maybe not resistance, but sort of healthy caution.
Right.
Let's put it this way.
And then Hans, do you want to comment on the introduction of fees in Sweden?
Yes, of course, I would like to answer questions. And the introduction of tuition fees has definitely reduced the number of applications from, non-European students, especially the first year. The second year, I guess, we see it's kind of rebound, but still it's lower. And as these tuition fees should be cost-based, it's a substantial difference between from zero up to quite substantial fees. And, of course, we provide a number of scholarships, but the number of scholarships doesn't, match the actual number of students. So that's the first question. And the second question about Scandinavian collaboration, I think it's a very good idea. I mean, Sweden is a small country, and the other Scandinavian countries are also small. So in most parts of the world, we are not very, well-known, and we need to collaborate to be visible. There is one example, for example, Nordic Center in Shanghai, where the different Scandinavian countries collaborate. But I would very much like to see more of this type of Scandinavian initiatives to promote.
Right. And I wonder if Nina could actually comment on this as well. Looking at the DAAD Germany, DAAD providing a lot of support and funding, and how does that work with whatever funding the European Commission provides, and how do you kind of work together on doing things together in Germany, but also looking at a more Europe-wide cooperation?
You mean for funding programs?
For funding programs.
Well, we are also the mothership, so to say, to the European, to the National Agency for Mobility in Germany for Erasmus and other programs. So we get a lot of European money, but mainly for mobility of students. Of course, we very closely look at what the European Union does. And for instance, there is going to be a big program called Strategic Partnerships from the European Union, which will have a different focus. I think it's not out yet, so we don't know quite, but it's going to be more with business links. So, of course, we try not to copy what they do, or we try to be, complementing, but not doing the same thing, which would be, silly. Working together with other countries, as in funding programs, I think we haven't done that yet, really. We are doing this in the marketing area, which is very important for us, and there we collaborate very closely with some of our European partners, especially sometimes also with you.
Right,
with
exactly. And one of those interesting initiatives, just to mention it, is something that is funded by the European Commission, is called PromoDoc. And the aim is to promote doctoral education in Europe, and it is several of the European national agencies that are working together to specifically do this in some of the key countries that send students to Europe. But the idea being, it is not just the standard undergraduate or graduate mobility, but really PhD
That's right.
mobility, which is a new approach. So let's take a few more questions. We have one here, and then one, Mohammed, up here.
Hi, I'm William Mitchell from the University of Warwick. Warwick's engaged in a very deep bilateral relationship with Monash University in Australia. And to echo Matthias's point about the amount of energy and investment required, I think we've found particularly there's a lot required in terms of joint decision-making and joint governance structures. We're also we've appointed a joint vice president as well, and that takes quite a lot of energy. I just wanted to invite the panel to comment on these issues of joint decision-making, joint governance, and some of the issues you face around that.
Great. Mohammed.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thank you, our colleagues. You have stated so many valuable comments in the avenue of challenges, financial challenges, funds. I wonder if you consider the area of culture and acculturation and curriculum change as one of the challenges in this process. Thank you.
Good. Thank you. Good questions. Who wants to start? Nina.
I could start maybe on this question, because for us, you know, we are only the funding body, and we try, as I said, we try to feel the pulse and try to bring in what we can see in other countries, try to bring it into the German system and vice versa. And so cultural aspects are very important to us, and one of the core elements of all the so-called structural programs that we try to implement and offer to the universities is to bring into the German system different cultures of teaching, of doing research, and so on. So this is a very, very important part to also this strategic partnership program. So you hit the nail on the head there, by the way.
Good. And do you both want to comment on this issue of joint governance, which I think is probably a very challenging issue?
I think one of the things that I said was we're only limited by our imagination to the kinds of collaborations that we can envisage. And we did have a discussion among the panel about, so what next? And actually the Warwick-Monash collaboration came up as one of our interesting examples of where you can take partnerships. And I also picked up on one of the posters. One of the commentators in the poster said, we're moving towards a future where globally networked university systems will be needed for the future. And I thought, isn't that the Warwick-Monash partnership? And that global networking, though, brings with it all that you've said. You're probably going to be teaching us what the answers are to this kind of joint university development, because I don't think anyone has quite got such a close relationship first. I do think this is a first. So we'll all be looking to you, Billy, to learn from Warwick-Monash experience.
Yeah, I can certainly agree with Suzanne. We're watching you closely. I think there are also other examples, like the alliance program between Columbia and the three universities in Paris that you know has similar features. I think with high universities, it's a learning process. As I said, you know, we don't think to have the right answers with regard to joint governance right now. We are just taking one step after the other. And I'm pretty sure there will be challenges that we will not be able to overcome maybe tomorrow, but if we work for a longer time together, these challenges might be overcome. If I may just make one statement with regard to the DAD funding, because you know we very much like such initiatives, but I think that what is lacking, this is not the fault of DAD, of course, but what is lacking, what is really needed to have similar programs in other countries. Because what we have experienced in that field, and that has also to do with, you know, learning processes and so on, that you know, if you work with a partner institution, you get the funding from the DAD, and you approach the partner and say, you're also supposed to put some money on the table, and they say, well, you don't have a DAD. Or they have a DAD, but their DAD doesn't have the same kind of funding program. So, you know, we're talking about joint governance and sort of exchange on policies and whatnot between universities, I think that's also needed between, or even more needed between the funding organizations in the future.
Right. And this, we have 4 minutes left, so let me ask one last question of the panel, and I hope each of you can address it in 30 seconds, and it's a good way, your last comments were exactly right. And let me appropriate a question that Jane Knight asked yesterday of her panel. So if we imagine we're here in 2023, in 10 years from now, so is this approach to strategic international partnerships just a step in the evolution of internationalization, or is it actually a new guiding framework for all kinds of international cooperation? So we'll start with Hans and we'll end with Matthias. 30 seconds each.
30 seconds. if we mean that, I mean, the inverse to strategic partnership would be a short-term ad hoc partnership. So in that way, of course, in 20, we will keep this type of, partnerships also in the future. But, I mean, I want to stress that strategic partnerships is not, I mean, you have a lot of other aspects within comprehensive internationalization that you also have to consider in the toolbox. So it's not, I mean, the only one that you use.
So strategic partnerships as one element in a lot of kinds of activities. Nina, your thoughts.
It's a really difficult question. I think one, I certainly think it's something that's going to stay because we have seen these many, many partnerships and now evolving into these more strategic partnerships. So they are going to stay, I hope. At least we are sponsoring them for at least 4 years, so they should stay at least for four years. And we always see our money as seed money. So we hope that it goes on. But I think something that Suzanne said should also be taken into consideration. You shouldn't be fixed on this partnership. Should it not evolve in the way or develop in the way that you want it, you must end it and find new strategic partners. So I think it's going to be an element, like Hans said, but maybe not a very fixed one, fixed for some years, and then let's see what comes from it. I hope that's a good enough answer.
I mean, the world is definitely a much smaller place than it used to be, and the idea of not working in partnership is just unimaginable. But we've said already about, and you mentioned it, how partnerships evolve. We've just talked about perhaps what is one of the most recent links, which is, for example, the example of Warwick Monash. But we will all be looking at that and reinventing them. So it is a constant process of reinvention. We can't predict what would happen in the external environment. We can't predict what will happen in the internal environments of our own institutions or our own countries. But I can't see any way in which we won't be continuing to work in partnership. I just hope we can become even more effective and more diverse in the partnerships that we can form.
Good. And Matthias, the last word.
I would totally agree. I think, you know, strategic partnerships will be in the future a very important part of a spectrum of different tools for internationalization within the universities. And I think we should not forget that universities usually are entities that are moving rather slowly. So we as, you know, decision makers and whatever kind, you know, we get together at Going Global and discuss current issues, trends, and future developments, whereas our institutions need to actually get to the point where we can really talk about a functioning strategic partnership. Maybe in 20 years' time, I'll be sitting here and saying, my president just came back from a discussion from a strategic partners president, and they were just about to fire a jointly appointed professor. I mean, that will be sort of, you know, that kind of thing that we don't have yet, and maybe in 20 years we will.
Good. Well, thank you all for your comments. Thank you for being here, and please help me thank the wonderful presenters. Thank you.
This is a podcast from the British Council's Going Global 2013.